Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie, and I'm going to leave a little ceremonial gap because half of my brother in dopeness is not here with me, so I'm doing it solo. But we're going to bring you On Point, and On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And super excited to be joined by Rick Leichtung, Director of Events at Ad Hoc, though that title doesn't really do justice to all the things you've done in New York nightlife, especially over the past, I'd say, decade to 15 years, give or take. So glad to have you with us, man.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm really excited about this interview because I love talking about guys who've seen the nightlife space and the event space from the inside. Because I think when you're just someone who's been to a spot or you've heard about what New York nightlife is all about, you have a very different perspective from what it really is when you're working at it. And I think actually to say you're a nightlife person maybe does a little bit of disservice because you're really, I would say, like an event person. You create events.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I really started out in concerts and, you know, I threw a bunch of, you know, DIY punk and rock shows and, you know, I really fell in love with it. And I kind of got to the point where, you know, I didn't really want the party to stop. So then I started doing more nightlife stuff, dance bookings and, you know, things that go after 4 a.m. and a lot of, you know, I don't know, experimenting, I guess. And yeah, you know, after a while, it just throwing events is just kind of something that completely consumes your life. And, you know, you want to do everything. You don't want to just do rock shows. You want to do hip hop. You want to do dance. You want to do experimental. You want to do seated. You want to do comedians. I mean, there's really, it's like there's no limit. It's like it's addictive.
What was that first major break that kind of got you like on this path that you thought like, okay, I could really start doing this as a full-time kind of gig? Did it come from a love of music or did it come from a love of music in an event capacity?
The decision to really devote my life to it really came out of necessity. Booking events, throwing shows was something that I did for fun and completely, you know, for free. Didn't pay myself, didn't really have interest in getting paid or making it my life. It was really more of a hobby. And I went through booking shows, ended up meeting a good friend of mine who ran Pitchfork. So then I worked over there for a couple years and then didn't really work out. And I was kind of on my ass and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do now. And the first opportunity I got was, you know, my old, you know, the guy I used to intern for, when I was a kid was like, hey, I got this warehouse venue. I think maybe you could do, something with it. It's called 285 Kent. Do you want to book it? And, you know, I was like, I guess so.
And when was this? Like around what year? So we can kind of set like a little bit of chronological timeline.
This was 2011. Okay. I came from as an expat to New York from San Francisco. Came here for college and felt really displaced. I was having a really hard time finding the community. You know, in Manhattan, with my fellow students, it just really wasn't what I was looking for, in a school and really in New York. And I kind of stumbled upon it, in the DIY scene, and just started sort of interning for that guy, Todd P, who owned 285 Kent. Yeah, really just found, you know, my niche and my social circles and sort of just my place, just by, you know, really working for him for free for a really long time.
Now, 285 Kent is I think one of the legendary spaces in this new iteration of events and nightlife, in the sense that it was one of the first and larger events in Brooklyn to really be producing events on a really big scale.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So like you guys ran into like a lot of issues, you know, like kind of walk through like some of those like things that are critical to the nightlife scene. There's legislation with the city, there's dealing with your neighbors, like all of those things go into it beyond just the physical putting on the event, you know? So what are some things that really stand out about that process to you?
I mean, you know, I guess as a club manager or whatever it was that I was, I mean, you really have to wear every hat, in the closet, you know, obviously you have to know how to book it, but then really, it did feel like running a club felt like you're really just managing a lot of other crazy personalities. You're managing promoters, you're managing, you know, the neighbors next door, which for us was Glasslands, which is another very well-known and well-respected venue. You know, having to manage that relationship, managing there was like this meter maid cop that would circle around our block every single night and, you know, either write us, you know, write tickets or get people, give people, alcohol summons to fill their quotas and managing, you know, feeding that person with, you know, tickets for their quotas. And, you know, it really just goes, especially managing other club promoters was also very difficult. Anybody who works in nightlife is fucking nuts. It's not. I wish it were. I mean, I don't think I'm nuts, but it's like you deal, especially
then
like.
Then how do you, if you're not nuts, but
I mean, I am nuts. I'm crazy to be doing it because, you know, it's, you know, I guess that's how I'm nuts, is that I decide to put up with it and, you know, do that. But it, you know, you just, you know, drugs are definitely a problem also in nightlife. So you've got, I mean, a lot of incredibly talented artists, organizers, etc., who are just like, you know, they're really doing what they're doing because they have no other choice, and that's the only thing that they're capable of doing. So you kind of just have all these people that are wildly creative but also incredibly inept all in one place trying to make something work, and it's, you know, it can be quite difficult.
Now the space itself was a wild open space.
Yeah.
Like, was that part of, by the design of what you guys wanted it to be, or was it more a function of literally in the DIY ethos, this is just what we got to fuck with? Like,
that's exactly what everything was. It was like, this is what we had, you know. We, I mean, you know, we were stuck with what we had. Something that we always wanted for the space was, you know, commercial plumbing. You know, plumbing. Just that, you know, it's like the kind of toilet that you take for granted. Then you go to a restaurant that just goes like, and it like sucks the shit into that. We dreamed about that because then, you know, we just had consumer toilet, you know, toilets. Like,
yeah.
And it just, you know, they you had two toilets for 400 people at least. And that was, it was a shit show. Yeah. I was hesitating. I'm glad that you said it.
And
I didn't, but. Yeah, I mean, that, you know, it was very much really using the materials that we had at our disposal for, you know, as best we possibly could. Yeah.
But people loved the space.
They did, yeah.
Like when, as the space was nearing its end, it felt like, at least for myself, I felt like, okay, this is sort of a death knell for this type of space, particularly in Williamsburg area.
Yeah.
You know, as more and more spaces started to close, you know, 285 Ken being one of them.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I feel like it was important in the DIY world because it was the first, not only was it a little larger, so we could potentially get artists that were playing the industry circuit, but also we really made a strong effort to not just be another white, indie rock space. We had a lot of hip hop. We had a lot of queer dance parties, and you know, it was really important to our identity that we engaged, the entire New York community and not just a very, very specific portion of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that kind of booking ethos rubbed off on a lot of people in Brooklyn. It kind of showed, you know, hey, you know, there are dance parties where club promoters aren't, you know, total scumbags, and you know, there are there's more intelligent you know, things that are happening specifically in the dance and electronic world, you know, that are there, that's more than just, you know, what most like people from the rock spectrum imagine the meatpacking scene to be. And, you know, harboring both of those communities and really trying to force them against each other by, you know, having a hardcore show go till 11 o'clock 11:30, and then right at midnight we switch into like a Chicago footwork show. That mixing those two together was very important to us and, you know, our identity as a space.
Now, you mentioned this idea of wanting to be inclusive to all the different parts, potentially, of New York and different communities, and making a space is going to be inviting to them.
Yeah.
Do you think that beyond having the desire to do that, the kind of psychological framework to think about doing that, the fact that you guys were a DIY space and had a different sort of economics built into it allowed you the freedom to do that as compared to a traditional sort of Manhattan style nightclub that has a, in these days, much bigger economic responsibility?
I mean, yeah, we did. I mean, running 285 Kent was definitely, it was all, you know, the financial bottom line was always looming in the background, because even though it was a building that wasn't really zoned for anything and could be shut down at any point, it was still Williamsburg waterfront property, which is expensive, and really it was more expensive than a lot of other, you know, places that were doing things that were similar on a very consistent basis. So yeah, we were really motivated to get all kinds of bookings in there for sure. But at the same time, really, you know, I would look at a spreadsheet and try and figure out all the numbers, and, you know, I still would just really book whatever I felt like or whatever I liked, because that was all I really knew. Even though the financial bottom line was present, you know, I feel like it was always booked with at least, you know, at least like one tiny shred of integrity with every single event, which is hard. You know, I ended up transitioning into Webster Hall shortly after 285 Kent ended up closing, which has a very different dynamic, where they want to be incredibly open, and, you know, they want to be open 7 nights a week, and they want to have multiple parties a night. And they just want to be the most inclusive space in New York City. And, you know, I think there's also a major financial bonus that you feel by virtue of being open and accepting to anything and everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you segued into Webster Hall, and we kind of talked. We mentioned it a little bit before we got on mic. Like, you obviously spent time working with the what's now the former team of Webster Hall. They are under new management, and they're going to be, I guess, renovating and reopening. And there's, again, is that other sense that, you know, things are constantly shifting in the city and changing. Like, what are some of your thoughts and impressions on the news about Webster Hall?
I mean, it was really interestingly timed, because I had actually left Webster Hall in March. And, you know, it wasn't really working out, for me personally. There were, some booking conflicts, that really was difficult for me to support as an individual. So I ended up leaving, and, you know, I talked to my other coworker, who was the other, there's three concert talent buyers, and one of them was myself, and another one was my coworker. And you know, when I kind of mentioned, you know, I think I'm gonna leave, you know, he followed suit, and we, you know, now we work together on Ad Hoc, and you know, he put in his notice on a Wednesday, and they ended up saying, okay, your last day will be, you know, will be Friday. Because there really wasn't much for him to do from there. It wasn't spiteful. Webster Hall family has been incredibly supportive of us through every step of the way. And then I think on Monday following, we learned that they were going to sell the building. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it all happened very fast. And, I wasn't personally a part of it, or I can't really shed any light on what led to it, but it came to a massive surprise to us, especially because Webster Hall really thrived without Bowery Presents for a long time. I'm sure, are you familiar with the whole, okay, great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But for the listeners who might not be with the structure Bowery Presents and the clubs that they rap, like, that's helpful. Like, if you can kind of.
Yeah. So basically, I think around in 2012 or 2011, basically, like, when I, probably 2014, actually. Sorry, I'm getting my years mixed up. Yeah. But basically, around the time that I left 285 Kent, or shortly thereafter, the, owner and the in-house bookers were kind of, they weren't satisfied with the relationship with Bowery Presents booking the Grand Ballroom, which is the large room that it's known for. And so they didn't renew their operating agreement with Bowery Presents. And then, they sort of they promoted the guy who was booking the smaller rooms to handle the big room. His name is Heath. They hired me and sort of got Ad Hoc to not replace Bowery Presents, because ultimately they're definitely not a replaceable company. They're incredibly their reach is insane, and they're very good at what they do. But as a band-aid, you know, Ad Hoc stepped in to try and get some of those cool hit, you know, bookings in there and to promote them, and started to handle the room independently. And as a result, and I would definitely have to double check a lot of these numbers and figures, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, our Webster Hall's numbers went up by 50%, when we were booking it in house. Polestar, which is sort of like the Billboard Hot 100 of concert tickets, you know, we got number two worldwide for club venues. I think every year that we were independent. And we got Club of the Year also in 2016. So, I mean, it was really thriving without Bowery Presents.
Yeah.
In my eyes.
It's interesting, because Webster Hall is one of those spots that had something for everybody.
It did.
You know?
It really did.
Yeah. Even I remember when I was a kid, like a teenager, it was one of the first clubs you can kind of like sneak into. Like, sure. It was kind of
not anymore.
Not anymore, man. But you know,
the security is
in the 80s.
Oh man, I wish I was around for the Ritz days. I mean,
that's
those days just sound so so amazing, honestly.
Things were a little easier to kind of segue your way into us. Like, that was your first introduction to like clubbing. Mm-hmm. In New York City was Webster Hall, and it's moved away from that. But as you get older, you start to have different relationships with the venue, like going to see like real shows in the ballroom. And, you know, I had other friends that were doing, the school night party there, or house party party there. Vashti and those folks.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, they had something for everybody.
They did. They really did. I mean, especially the club nights were really unique. I felt like they did it in a way that was very inclusive for everybody. It wasn't, you know, it definitely didn't, it didn't feel, I felt like a lot of people when they go to a club, honestly, they feel, a lot of people feel very isolated and frankly priced out. I mean, I don't feel like I belong at a place like Cielo. which is, you know, probably an excellent club. I've never been, because I know that it costs, it's very expensive to go.
Yeah.
Drinks are expensive and, you know, I'm not, I just don't, I just can't.
Yeah, man. The drinks fucking hit you drinks, over the head, man.
You know, Webster drinks, not cheap either, for sure. But it's, there is a basic sense of accessibility, and the talent that they had there appealed to a lot of different people. They really went out of the way. I mean, especially any club in New York City that's going out of their way to host hip hop booking should also be acknowledged.
Yeah. Cause that's rare.
It is.
Yeah.
Being an outside promoter and wanting to get more hip hop bookings and convincing venues to commit to them is very, very difficult.
Why do you think that's such a challenge given the scope and range of hip hop?
I mean, I think that there is a stigma around the crowd that hip hop brings. There's a lot of artists who, you know, I don't know, they might have issues with the local precinct or something like that. I mean, it was not uncommon for, you know, if we were to announce a show that maybe there was an opener who had a warrant to open or something like that, and it was literally, you know, the precinct would be like, hey, you know, we're gonna be here, or maybe, you know, maybe it's not a good idea for you to, you know, have this event with this particular person. I mean, it also,
but does that affect the venue? Because when I go to a lot of hip hop shows, it's mostly white kids.
Well, yeah, it can be, right? But it's, I'm not, you know, like, yeah, no, it's funny. It's funny. I mean, yeah, the big ones especially, but I mean, there was an event specifically that Webster Hall championed and developed called House Party.
Yeah.
It was really great. Really, really great weekly. There's really nothing like it. Except now, actually, one of the promoters behind it is now doing something at Highline on a monthly basis, I think, with Boiler Room. I forget what it's called.
So, like, Just Blaze was DJing there.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, Bashti was there. Incredible lineups.
Yeah.
Amazing lineups. And they only had, like, a week to promote to people that they would get. It was insane. But, yeah, there is, I mean, you know, from a club perspective, you get a lot of pressure from the community board. You know, if there's, let's say there happens to be a rise in crime between, you know, the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. on the night that you happen to have, you know, a hip-hop show or hip-hop shows, community board and the precinct are going to be like, oh, this is the problem. This, you know, this hip-hop show is gathering the wrong crowd into the neighborhood. Or, you know, it's just, it's such,
were those, an, it's, were they such, those links, or were they just assuming they were, I'm just, I'm,
I
like,
mean, it's impossible to tell, because yeah, there's, yeah, no, you know, I mean, you never know. You really don't. And mm-hmm. It's just, you're going to get pushback from the police if you are hosting, you know, a bunch of hip hop, especially the best, most up and coming hip hop. It can be problematic. You know, for a myriad of reasons that are beyond, you know, our control, really. Yeah. Because frankly, you know, we want to create a safe haven, and a platform. But are just constantly, oppressed by and pushed around in one direction or another. And I think that's a reason why there's not, you know, that may be a reason why there's not more hip hop in, you know, a lot of Bowery Presents venues, perhaps.
Yeah.
I mean, it's speculative for certain. And, you know, I definitely can't speak on their behalf, but I mean, there's really not a lot of it that happens. And, Bowery Presents really looks over a lot of the, small to medium clubs that, you know,
they go up and down.
They do.
From like Mercury all the way up.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you could get a gig at SOBs, which is good, you know, but then there's no middle ground between the two.
Because I was going to say SOBs still has like a lot of hip hop, a lot of R&B.
Yeah.
But they also do a lot of like the label promoting it.
Yeah.
Kind of nights, you know.
Yeah,
definitely. Rather than like a promoter putting it together, which is a little different.
Yeah. And you know, and really the next step up that I don't see necessarily as a primarily like white space is really Irving. And Irving's that's a 1,000 cap venue. Yeah. That means you really, really, really need to be able to get people out.
I mean,
you got to have, you know, you need like a whole team of people behind you. You need a label. You need a press person, manager. I mean, you know, promoter plus Live Nation. I mean, it's like the amount of resources it takes to sell 1,000 tickets. It's, you know, it's considerable. And that, you know, not a lot of people have those resources.
The barriers that are in place.
Yeah.
So I'm good. I'm going to get out on this question. I asked Steve Lewis this as well, like his kind of perspective on the future of nightlife and events. And he's actually very bullish, you know, like he's very positive about it. Like, you know, he's that dude, you know him. Like what are your kind of thoughts about it? Like you've kind of seen a wide swath of stuff. You're running your own company. Like, what's your perspective on like New York nightlife? Good, bad, indifferent?
Something that I would like to see for nightlife and really like a lot of DJ culture is I wish that a lot of them would sort of play a similar circuit that the national touring circuit does. I mean, just a lot of DJs, they don't release music in the same way that rock artists do. And as a result, I mean, there's no records a lot of the time and there's no, it's just a different animal. It's a different beast. And I hope that, more DJs and producers embrace the sort of like album model and find really good labels that will service them properly. I find that a lot of electronic labels are just, they just don't really know what they're doing and they don't have it down to a science like a lot of these major indie labels do that aren't putting out that kind of music. So it seems like electronic music and hip hop music and everything in between is incredibly underserviced, underpromoted, underdeveloped. And I really, really hope that we see more of that because there's so much potential. A lot of the artists that end up playing those kinds of events, they play parties. And parties are promoted in a way where, you know, the artists, it's not that the artists aren't important, but they really can take a backseat to the party itself. And, you know, in the end, the artists end up losing a lot of like hard ticket value, which means, you know, they can't, it's really hard for them to grow. And I wish I could see that happen. As far as New York nightlife in general, it's really hard to say. I mean, I don't know how long Output's going to be around. Shemansky, I don't know where that's going to go. You know, I'm not in touch with the meatpacking culture at all.
Yeah.
I think that Pop Gun's new room elsewhere is going to have a lot of electronic programming, but, I don't really know how that's going to look, to be honest with you. I don't really know. I have no idea. But
that's where the opportunity is going to keep doing fresh stuff.
Oh, man. Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
That's what we need you for, man. To do fresh things.
Yeah. I try. Trying really hard.
All right.
Yeah.
So mixed, but we're going to keep it fresh.
I mean, there's always going to be people who are going to want to party, and there's always going to be young, hungry people wanting to prove themselves creatively or within their, or, you know, even, you know, financially boasting about, oh, I got like this many hundred people at my party and blah, blah, blah. Those people are always going to come to New York because that's what New York is. It's a bunch of like ridiculous personalities like that all in one place, which is why I love New York, actually. Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. It's a reason, but, yeah, I mean, it's always going to, you know, nightlife is always going to push forward in New York. It's always going to be something. I don't know if it's going to be as culturally as rich as it was in the, you know, the 70s or 80s and 90s. It's hard to say. It seems like techno is really, you know, finding a new voice here. But, you know, the hottest techno club is Bossa Nova, and Bossa Nova holds like 100 people. It's a tiny scene.
Yeah.
When you really think about it. And that's the most interesting emerging thing that that we have right now.
Well, brother, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
We're going to keep trying to make it happen.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you coming out. I appreciate you joining us. And that's On Point.